From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, Fatty Arbuckle, Hollywood's first celebrity scandal, and the first morality campaign in Hollywood. We talked to Jerry Stahl about his novel I, Fatty, which is out soon in paperback. Stahl also is the author of Permanent Midnight, his memoir about being addicted to heroin while writing popular TV shows. Also, we'll speak with Barbara Carroll. She's 80 years old and still swinging at Manhattan's swankiest jazz clubs. She'll be performing this weekend at the Algonquin Hotel. And a performance artist takes her work to the big screen. Film critic David Edelstein reviews a new film called Me and You and Everyone We Know. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. The story we're about to hear, about a Hollywood scandal and a morality crusade, goes back to the silent film era. Fatty Arbuckle was one of silent film's biggest stars, the fat, funny man of many Keystone Cop movies and other silent films. He was beloved and made a fortune. But his career was ruined in 1921 when he was accused of raping and murdering a model named Virginia Rappe. She died of an internal infection and a ruptured bladder, illnesses Arbuckle was accused of causing during the alleged rape. At his third trial, he was acquitted, but his name remained Hollywood poison. Also, his trial helped lead the way to an obsession with Hollywood scandal and to the first crusades against immorality in the movie industry. Our guest, Jerry Stahl, has written a novel based on Arbuckle's life called I, Fatty. It's about to be released in paperback. Stahl also is the author of the popular memoir Permanent Midnight about the years when he led a double life as a heroin addict and as writer of such TV shows as Alf, Moonlighting, and 30-something. Terry began her 2004 interview with Jerry Stahl by asking him to read from the beginning of I, Fatty. The novel is written as if it were Arbuckle's memoir.
Even if I never touched Virginia Rappe or any other female, people had their reasons for believing, for wanting to believe I'd done something worth hating me for. I hated the name Fatty, and I made a career out of being that name. Buster Keaton said that to get people to love me, I became what I loathed the most. Buster was the one pal who stood by me through it all. So, before we really get going here, I just have to say this. Something strange happens when you lose everything. Something strange happened to me. All those years of being lucky, being successful, first comic actor to direct his own movies, first to make $1 million a year. I never felt comfortable. I had to pay a bootlegger to feel even half good, and after that, a croaker for narcotics. Once all my money and all my luck was used up, I could relax. I wanted to die, but at least the feeling was familiar. Does this make sense? Before the court lynched me, I was as big a success as Daddy was a failure. And I needed the hooch more than he did, sometimes more. After the St. Francis fiasco, I didn't need the drink. I mean, I did, but not the same way. Thanks to Virginia, I had an excuse to feel the way I had always felt, but could never explain when things were aces. But there I go, rushing the gag.
That's Jerry Stahl reading from his new book, I, Fatty. It's a novel based on the life of Fatty Arbuckle. Jerry, reading this novel made me feel like I was reading a history of early Hollywood, and there were actually a lot of parallels to what Hollywood is like today. But I'm wondering what made you think about Fatty Arbuckle as a subject.
I kind of stumbled across him by accident. I was really interested in the notion of American history and of America as a kind of pharmocracy, doing a history of America via narcotics.
Because, oh, farm with a PH. Okay.
You're way ahead of me. Yeah, and see, back then, Bayer made heroin and sold it over the counter as the housewife's friend, as it was known, and to keep the kiddies from coughing at night, whereas their new fangled crazy product, aspirin, was considered a little dicey. And then I stumbled across the fact that Fatty Arbuckle, at one point in his life, got so strung out on heroin that he had to wear a fat suit in public. And the notion of this guy leading the double junkie life of this fat suit and sweating in the horrific Los Angeles heat and then going home, taking it off and fixing was so riveting and so just somehow sad. It made me fall in love with the guy. So I decided to just write about Hollywood and that particular time in America via him.
You mean he was so wasted from the heroin that he lost so much weight he had to put on a fat suit?
That's right. Adolf Zucker had it made for him because he had to go on tour to promote films, but he could barely walk. He had lost a ton of weight because he had a carbuncle that an intern botched while trying to lance it, and as was the habit, no pun intended, of the day, he gave him heroin, and Fatty got strung out, and the studio said, okay, you have to kick it, and they built a kick bin in his own home, and when it was all over, he was so thin, he had to wear a fat suit.
What is Fatty Arbuckle's place in movie history as an actor and as a director?
His place is kind of twofold. One, he was the first guy to make $1 million a year. But on terms of artistic achievement, he invented the pie fight. And he was the first comic actor who got to direct his own movies. So, in fact, he was the first actor who had that kind of creative control to do what he wanted to do on screen.
When Fatty Arbuckle started in movies, movies were not particularly respectable the way you describe it. You, in your book, you write, and this is in Fatty Arbuckle's voice, working in flickers, as they were still being called, was out of the question. Everyone knew that the only people who'd lower themselves to step in front of a camera were stage actors who couldn't get work or couldn't stay sober enough to keep it if they got it. And then later on, he says, movies. Only people so poor they couldn't afford a vaudeville ticket go to the Nickelodeon. Why were movies so looked down on then?
Because they didn't really exist yet. And it's a really interesting thing because in Hollywood at the time, apartment houses would literally have signs out front that said, no dogs, no colored, no actors. Because the kind of people who became actors were essentially the sort of, bartenders, wrestlers, dope fiends, all kind of peripheral riffraff who couldn't make it in what was considered legitimate stage work. So it was really embarrassing for Fatty. In fact, he was engaged. I'm going to call him Roscoe because he preferred to be called Roscoe. But he was engaged to be married, and he didn't want his future wife's parents, to know that he was an actor. Better he was a hobo or a pickpocket or something vaguely more respectable.
When he did start making movies, what kind of roles did he get? He was famous for being fat. How did that affect who he played on screen?
He always tended to play the innocent. He was one of those guys who somehow every other movie he was either in a diaper or in drag. And he had that kind of gender-free baby face kind of look that made him very endearing to people. You know how Rush Limbaugh used to say, I'm the kind of man who you could trust to babysit your daughter? He had sort of that quality, the Limbaugh-like sexless quality, before Rush, of course, got busted for drugs.
Let's talk a little bit about the scandal that made Fatty Arbuckle even more famous than he already was. And I think a lot of people who don't know his movies at all know him as somebody who was involved in a scandal, even if they can't tell you what the scandal was. So he was involved in this big Hollywood party. What was he alleged to have done that night?
Actually, it was a Hollywood party, but it was a Hollywood party in San Francisco, which is where a lot of the actors of the time would go because, remember, this was during Prohibition, and they thought that the liquor was better up in San Francisco and easier to get hold of. So he's in room 1221 of the swanky St. Francis Hotel, and to just give you the Cliff Notes version, there was an actress named Virginia Rappe who stumbled into his rooms during the party. And he already knew she had a reputation as being a rather nasty drunk and had, in fact, given half the Keystone Cops gonorrhea and the other half lice. But what happened is she started taking her clothes off, going into a fit, screaming. So not knowing what else to do, he put her down in the adjacent room where he was staying and came back later to take a bath. And she was screaming and in fever and just in a horrific state. So not knowing what else to do, he decided that he took Buster Keaton's advice, who had once told him that when a woman is going crazy, what she really needs is something cold placed on her female area. So Fatty, you have to picture, is standing there in a towel, leaning over this woman, pressing a cold champagne bottle to her private area, as I like to call it. And it looked real bad. And a woman named Maude Delmont, who was a known blackmailer, came in, caught him in the act, and the next thing you know, Hearst is making a huge story out of it. The DA who wants to run for governor is using it as an excuse to get rid of these moral pariahs from Hollywood polluting San Francisco. And the right-wing Christian fundamentalists, who of course basically hated Jews for corrupting America's youth by running Hollywood, were using as an excuse to shut down the entire industry. And he was innocent, and he couldn't have sex. He was impotent pretty much his whole life.
So was he accused of raping her or of raping her with the champagne bottle?
Both. He was accused of raping her and penetrating her with a foreign object, and then a lot of quotes were attributed to him by Hearst, who, another interesting kind of sideline, basically invented the tabloids behind Fatty Arbuckle's scandal.
And you mentioned he was impotent, and I have to say here that you earlier in the book say that his girth left him with a weakened nuptial muscle, which I thought was a very clever way of describing his impotency. How did you come up with the nuptial muscle?
I really love the lingo and argot of the time, and I just steeped myself in all kind of odd medical manuals, and there were weird slang dictionaries of the era, and there's all kind of different books and text. And after a while, sort of by process of osmosis, you start thinking in these kind of terms. When that was just a, sort of an age when the wisecrack and the scientific description, sort of like those, you know, bad health movies you had to watch in, you know, hygiene class in high school, I think it had its origin at that period. So that kind of language just began to permeate the way I wrote.
Well, so here's Fatty Arbuckle being accused of rape, and at the same time he's actually impotent. And you have him saying in your book, "The truth is, and I know this must sound loathsome, I preferred the penalty for committing sin to the shame of admitting that I couldn't commit it. There, I said it." It's a kind of interesting predicament.
It was a very bizarre dilemma the guy faced, because Hearst kept writing about his quote-unquote manly equipment, whereas his only defense would have been for his wife to get up in court and say, well, you know, his manly equipment is not particularly manly. But Fatty was so mortified by that that he literally was opting to go to the chair rather than admit that he couldn't do what he was, in effect, accused of doing.
And what was the information that was finally revealed that acquitted him in the third trial? There were two hung juries and then a third jury. The foreman of the third jury said, "Acquittal is not enough for Roscoe Arbuckle. We feel that a great injustice has been done."
So they actually apologized to him. What was ultimately revealed was that the woman he was accused of raping, who had, of course, the Hearst papers had portrayed as a virginal young victim and a chaste young lady. At one point, they even decided she was descended from European royalty, had in fact been a prostitute since the age of 14 and had a series of abortions and had a botched abortion the day before.
So how did the information finally become admissible in court?
What happened was that once he was accused, it didn't matter if he was innocent or not, because it's sort of like if a clown commits a crime, you realize you're never going to look at him the same. So once he was accused and it was clear Paramount couldn't use him anymore, Adolf Zucker arranged for the DA to suppress all the information about his main accuser, Maud Delmont, who was herself a woman with about 21 allegations of blackmail against her. None of this came out in the first two trials. It finally came out in the last trial. So it was less about the fact of the botched abortion, because Fatty's lawyers were under the impression that had they put that out in court, it would have looked like they were slandering the name, the good name of the dead woman, even though she never had a good name. So what came out instead was the fact that Maud Delmont, his main accuser, who the defense was never allowed to bring to court and the prosecution never brought into court, it came out that she, in fact, was completely morally bankrupt herself, and the case just went to pieces, and the deliberation of the jury took 6 minutes.
Jerry Stahl speaking to Terry Gross last year. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2004 interview with Jerry Stahl, author of the novel I, Fatty. It's based on the life of the silent film star Fatty Arbuckle, whose career was ruined by a scandal.
So from your knowledge of Hollywood history, would you say that this is the point in time when groups trying to uphold their vision of morality start accusing Hollywood of being morally bankrupt and morally corrupt?
Right, and it's a double-edged thing. It was that Hollywood was morally bankrupt and corrupting America's youth, but also with the subtler level of anti-Semitism, because the fact was that Hollywood was run by Jews. These people didn't like Jews, and the way to attack them and put them out of business was to accuse Hollywood itself of somehow having a conspiracy to corrupt good Christian children. What made Fatty's case so ironic is that even as this was welling up, Fatty's movies were one of the few that were considered like okay and family friendly by the morality squad. So the level of betrayal when this happy-go-lucky, threat-free clown turned out to have been a complete degenerate perv made it even more troubling for these people.
And did they know about his addiction to heroin?
Of course not, no.
Because heroin was legal at the time, and a doctor prescribed it, so I was wondering.
It was legal, but it was also a big Hollywood secret. In fact, the first matinee idol of the day, a guy named Wallace Reed, was the guy who always played the upstanding, good guy, male lead, gorgeous, handsome, brave, in fact, died of heroin withdrawal and was an addict the entire time. And Paramount itself had been supplying him heroin to keep him going. Cecil B. DeMille had to give him a lecture on how he had to keep from doing drugs when, in fact, the studios would slip him morphine to keep the movies going.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jerry Stahl. He's the author of Permanent Midnight, and his new book is called I, Fatty, and it's a novelized version of the story of Fatty Arbuckle, who was a silent film star, nicknamed Fatty because he was obese, and he was the first Hollywood actor to become a millionaire, and his career was ruined by a scandal. Did you go back and read the articles of the time? Because, like, there's a few things you quote, and I'm not sure if they're real or not. There's a passage in which he's comparing the articles about him with the reality of his life. He says, I had to do a lot of interviews, but they weren't really interviews. They were performances. They had me saying a lot of things I didn't know I'd said until I picked up a movie magazine, like, let me handle the Huns, boasts jokester Arbuckle. I'll find the Kaiser and sit on his head. Or they'd say, whatever success I've had, I credit to my mother's love and my father's guidance. That's from an article called Fatty Talks to Young People. And, of course, the real Fatty Arbuckle had a horrible family life, and he hated his parents. So did you actually find the articles that had these quotes?
Yeah, there's a ton of articles like that. And the really grotesque thing about it is Fatty's father, who used to beat him mercilessly, routinely, hated him on sight, blamed him for destroying his mother's womanhood and ultimately killing her. Fatty had always to describe him in articles as a, quote, gentleman farmer. And it just was the beginning of that kind of double life that went all the way, you know, continued to Rock Hudson, where the real acting job on the part of the actors was trying to play the part of real-life person that the studios were trying to pretend they were.
Let me say, when you say that his father accused Fatty Arbuckle of destroying his mother's womanhood, you mean during the childbirth process, that Fatty was so large
he
tore up his mother during the delivery.
He was a 16-pound baby, and mom was never the same, needless to say. And his father just hated the kid and beat him mercilessly when he was even around to beat him. And then, of course, in magazine interviews, Fatty got to talk about what a wonderful guy his dad was.
You know, in some ways, it seems to me that your novel is not only about Fatty Arbuckle. It's a kind of contrast between Fatty Arbuckle's life as somebody who grew up with a father who hated him, who ended up accidentally becoming a heroin addict because it was prescribed to him by his doctor, somebody who was unfairly accused of raping a woman to death, had his career ruined, someone who was so fat he couldn't even enjoy the conjugal pleasures of marriage. And yet he is the person who is, you know, ridiculed and condemned by the morality groups of the time, the morality groups who were all, you know, too happy to believe that he really was the murderer of the woman. And I think it's in some ways that this book is about the difference between your view of the human condition and the view expressed by certain groups who see themselves as upholders of morality.
That's really nicely put. It's the classic case of people who find themselves having the power to judge others, accusing somebody, not just unjustly, but for the wrong thing, because they are, for whatever reason, threatened. So here are people threatened by Fatty Arbuckle, a guy who can't even have sex. And I don't think it's that different from people wanting to ban gay marriage. It's as if somehow if gay people got married, all the straight men around would start marrying other men, you know? And it's just that crazy thing that happens when people become the arbiters of morality and are in a position to more or less destroy other people's lives by their own power.
Jerry Stahl speaking to Terry Gross in 2004. We'll hear more of their conversation in the second half of the show. I'm David Bean Cooley, and this is Fresh Air. Major funding for Fresh Air comes from this and other NPR member stations, and from Barnes & Noble, publishers of Holy Father, Pope Benedict XVI, Pontiff for a New Era, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. Additional support for NPR comes from Dell Paperbacks, publisher of Fearful Symmetry by Morag Yass, a novel of music and murder starring concert cellist Sarah Selkirk, set in Bath, England. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Coming up, more with writer Jerry Stahl, whose book I, Fatty is out next month in paperback. Also, the jazz stylings of Barbara Carroll. She'll tell us about her long and successful career playing jazz piano and singing. And film critic David Edelstein reviews a new independent feature that he calls a cinematic hope chest. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, filling in for Terry Gross. Jerry Stahl, before writing the novel I, Fatty, about the Fatty Arbuckle scandal from that silent film star's point of view, wrote his own memoir called Permanent Midnight. It was about his days in TV, when he wrote scripts for such shows as 30-something, Moonlighting, and Alf, while wrestling with his own addiction to heroin. Terry spoke with Jerry Stahl in 2004. At this point in their conversation, they were discussing what Arbuckle's story had to say about the human condition.
Your view of the human condition seems to include things like people have appetites that aren't necessarily good for them. People have appetites that they can't necessarily fulfill. People are often born into conditions that are bleak and will taint the rest of their lives, that life can be very emotionally and spiritually difficult.
That is true. But what it boils down to for me, essentially, is that all our secrets are the same, no matter where we come from. Pain's pain, and it hurts. And the difference is that people in a position to somehow not experience what others go through feel entitled to judge how they react to those experiences. And what made this such a beautiful story for me was the fact that, you know, I fell in love with Fatty not just because he was a victim, but because he was just sort of emblematic of the classic wrong place, wrong time kind of guy who ends up at the, you know, being basically shunned by people who no doubt saw him as Satan's spawn and conveniently created an enemy that wasn't even there. And it just never changes. And the similarities to today are so obvious as to, you know, not even bear mentioning.
In the opening of your book, you were writing in your own voice.
Mm-hmm, in the introduction.
In the introduction. And you describe basically overdosing and falling unconscious on a street that happened to be the street that Fatty Arbuckle used to live on. Did that actually happen?
Yeah, this was a bizarre coincidence. Back in the early 80s, right at the dawn, pre-dawn of the crack era, there was a lot of drug sales going on Adams, where Mr. Arbuckle used to live. And at one point, I was sort of picked up by the police and told to, you know, as they used to say, lie lips down on the ground. And years later, I realized where that was in fact Fatty Arbuckle's front lawn. It's kismet.
We talked several years ago after your memoir, Permanent Midnight, was published about what it was like for you to have been a heroin addict and then, you know, get off it, and also what it was like to be writing for television when you were secretly a junkie and, you know, shooting up in the bathroom. So it's been years since you were addicted. Is it still hard?
Let's just say I am certainly in touch with my own inner Fatty since that experience. And it's tricky. One thing, what you believe is that, oh, I need all that stuff to make me, you know, write really dark and edgy. And if I get off all the drugs, I'm become a, you know, Johnny Bland guy. But one thing Hubert Selby, the late Hubert Selby, who kind of saved my life and really helped me with my writing, explained to me was, you don't get it. Once you give up the drugs and the alcohol and all that behavior, you don't become more boring. You realize how dark you really are, and there's no buffer. And that's when it really gets terrifying. And that has proved to be true. And at this point, you know, I'm that guy who goes and picks up my daughter after school and drives her home and does homework. So, you know, it's like on the one hand, you're Iggy Pop. On the other hand, you sort of become Fred McMurray. So at the end of the day, you're like Iggy McMurray, you know?
So was it scary to meet your demons without the sedative of heroin to intervene between the two of you?
Sure. But what you realize is that we're all in love with our pain. You know, we're so romanticized about the suffering this and the suffering that. And, you know, I get it. I mean, all my heroes were dope fiends, you know, Keith Richards and Miles Davis and Charlie Parker and Lenny Bruce. But, you know, when I was getting clean, Keith wasn't there with a warm towel. So you realize kind of the hollowness of that particular cliche. So I have changed cliches. And now I'm that guy on the other side. And it is much more surreal than drugs ever were, much more interesting, and much less predictable.
Well, Jerry Stahl, thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Jerry Stahl speaking to Terry Gross last year. His novel, I, Fatty, about silent film star Fatty Arbuckle, whose career was ruined by scandal in the 1920s, will be published in paperback July 5th. Coming up, singer and pianist Barbara Carroll. This is Fresh Air.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, Birdland proudly presents Barbara Carroll.
Pianist Barbara Carroll from her new album Live at Birdland. She started recording in the late 1940s when a woman jazz musician was still considered quite a novelty. At the Kennedy Center's Women in Jazz Festival 2 years ago, she received the Lifetime Achievement Award for her body of work, work that's still continuing. Barbara Carroll also sings. For 24 years, Barbara Carroll played and sang at the Carlyle Hotel in Manhattan, the hotel that also was home to Bobby Short. Carroll celebrated her 80th birthday earlier this year. This Sunday and next, she performs at another well-known and cozy New York night spot, the Oak Room, an intimate space at the Algonquin Hotel. Terry spoke with Barbara Carroll in 2003.
You started performing at a time when there were very few women jazz musicians, or at least successful ones. How did you feel about always being referred to as, like, the lady pianist? I imagine you were thought of as almost like a novelty act because you were a woman.
Well, you put it very nicely. You're saying the lady pianist. Actually, what people would say when they were giving you the ultimate compliment was, gee, you play good for a girl, or, worse still, you play just like a man. You know, so when I was growing up, those were the accolades that one got.
Now, you sing as well as play piano, but on your records, you usually just sing a few tracks on each recording. Were you ever afraid, particularly when you were getting started, that if you sang too much, you would be thought of as a singer and not so much as a pianist, and it would take away from your reputation as an instrumentalist? You'd be, you know, regarded as like another girl singer.
Well, actually, I must confess, Terry, it wasn't that. I was afraid to sing, not because they'd think that I was a singer, because they'd think I wasn't a singer. And I always knew a lot of lyrics. I knew the lyrics to everything that I played. I had a sister who was really crazy about all the good songs, and she knew the lyrics to everything. She had a voice that was, not terribly attractive sometimes, but that didn't keep her from singing. So she used to sing everything. I learned all the words to everything. But I was always afraid to sing because I didn't think I had the voice. I didn't think I had the range. I was totally insecure about it. And today I don't think of myself as a singer either. I think of myself as a pianist who sings. And I have come to the conclusion that the important thing when you're singing is to tell the story. And I console myself with that, you see. I'm telling the story. And I love to sing. But essentially, my first love is playing the piano.
Do you remember the first time you actually sang in public?
I sang a little bit on my RCA recordings, which were some of the first records I made in the 1950s. And then when I began playing at the Carlyle, I was just playing the piano, and then people would always say, "Oh, sing it!" You know, they'd hear a certain song that they loved, and they'd sing it, you know. And so I would sing it, and little by little, I gained some confidence in singing, and it's a great joy to sing.
You mentioned that you sang a few tracks on some of your very early records. Why don't we hear one of those? And this is from your 1956 recording, "It's a Wonderful World." And we'll hear "At Long Last Love," in which you're featured at the piano and on vocals.
Is it an earthquake or is it a shock? Is this the good turtle soup or merely the mock? Is it a cocktail, this feeling of joy? Or is what I feel the real McCoy? Is this for all time or merely a lark? Is it Granada I see or only Asbury Park? Is this a fancy not worth dreaming of? Or is it at long last love?
That's Barbara Carroll, piano and vocals, recorded in 1956 from her album It's a Wonderful World. You know, it's interesting. You said you were never trained as a singer and, you know, you were very shy about your singing. You didn't think you were very good. You were trained as a pianist. You studied piano from the time you were a girl. You went to the New England Conservatory of Music. Did you, in that sense, think of your singing and your piano playing as mismatched because you were so untrained as a singer?
No, you see, I began playing the piano when I was about 4 or 5 years old. I had two older sisters who had been given piano lessons and violin lessons and all kinds of lessons, but they didn't want to practice and they weren't really interested in playing. And I was about 10 years younger than my middle sister. I was the youngest in the family. And by the time I came along, my parents were rather disenchanted with the idea of going for all that money for the piano lessons again because, you know, they had had bad experiences with my two sisters. So I was playing when I was 5 and 6, and I really wanted to study. And I finally prevailed upon them to let me study classical music, which I began studying when I was 8 years old. I studied classical music until I was about 15 in Worcester. And then, as I say, I went to the conservatory for a little bit. I didn't feel, your question was, did I feel mismatched because I had formal training in playing the piano and I had not in singing? No, in jazz, actually, I don't know that you have to have formal training in singing. I'm sure it might help, but I'm sure that many of the great jazz singers did not have that formal training.
I think most did not.
I would say that, yes, absolutely. As far as formal training in playing the piano, I certainly think it's helpful in giving you the ability, the technique, the technical ability to play the piano and play whatever you want, because if you have the technique, you can go ahead and play jazz or play whatever, you know, whatever comes to mind.
How were you first exposed to jazz?
Well, when I was in Worcester, I used to hear the radio, listened to the radio a lot, and they were live. You know, in those days, there were remote broadcasts, that's what they called them, which meant they were live performances from jazz rooms, from hotels, from places where there were bands and there were instrumentalists playing wonderful jazz music. And that's what I heard when I was in Worcester. And then I heard Nat King Cole and his trio. And that was as if a light went on for me, because Nat Cole was my very first favorite pianist. He was a marvelous pianist. A lot of people remember him as a great singer, which of course he was. But for me, he was the excitement about playing jazz piano. And then after that, I heard Art Tatum and, later on, Thelonious Monk and Bud Powell and Oscar Peterson, et cetera, et cetera. But it was Nat Cole first.
In 1957, I know you were playing in a trio with your husband, the bass player Joe Shulman. This was your first husband, your late husband. And was that helpful, having a husband who was also a jazz musician? And here's what I'm thinking. Because a lot of men in general and jazz musicians in particular in this instance might have thought of you as like an available woman, you know, like a chick who plays, but we know what she really wants. it could have really kind of interfered with your ability to just play and not be misinterpreted, if you know what I mean. So like if your husband's there, then like, okay, you're no longer, quote, available. So you're just like a piano player. You're just there for professional reasons. No one could misinterpret that. Was that helpful?
I don't know if it was helpful or not helpful. I only know that we had a really wonderful marriage. He was an extraordinary musician, and we had a marriage that was unusual because we worked together, and we were together all the time. So it was really quite wonderful. Unfortunately, Joe died when he was 33 years old. We had only been married for 3 years, and he had a heart attack.
That's so young.
Suddenly, we were on Fire Island. We had taken the summer off because we were working so much, and we just wanted a little downtime, and just out of the blue, this happened.
Was it hard to get back to work after he died? I mean, to resume your life?
Yes, after he died, it was very difficult because I wanted to work. I wanted to go back to work. But you see, I was working with a trio, and I needed a bass player. And so I had to audition bass players, and it was extremely difficult because nobody played as well as he, and, of course, nobody could fill his shoes in any way. So it took a long time. But it didn't take a long time to get back to work. I went back to work rather quickly. It took a very long time to get over that.
Right. A question about clothing for you. On your latest recording, One Morning in May, you're wearing a black turtleneck sweater and you're seated at the piano. On your recordings from the 1950s, at least the couple that I have with me, you're wearing more like, you know, a cocktail dress or an evening gown, something with straps that, you know, with bare shoulders, you know, that... So what was expected of you in terms of your image in the 1950s when you were one of the few women pianists recording?
Exactly what you said. Bare shoulders, cocktail dress, you know, a little cleavage if you were fortunate enough to have it. And that's the way it was. You know, I look at old photographs of myself, professional photographs that were taken during that time in the 1950s, and they're all very sultry and glamorous. There were photographers at that time like Maurice Seymour and James Kriegsman and Bruno of Hollywood, and they took these marvelous pictures with lighting and shadows and, you know, just made you look terrific. And it was all glamour, and it was wonderful. Things have changed, though. You know, I don't dress that way now. I don't wear things that are bare-shouldered and cut out. I'm more casual, in keeping, I think, with the spirit of the times.
In speaking of the glamour photos, on your album We Just Couldn't Say Goodbye, which is from the 1950s, you're at the piano wearing this, you know, a cocktail dress with straps, with the cleavage and the bare shoulders. And there's three men in suits with their elbows on the piano, listening intently and staring at you admiringly.
Well, I'm glad you said staring at me admiringly. Actually, what happened was that they needed a cover photograph, and somebody at RCA Victor got the great idea, you know, let's get a couple of guys standing around the piano looking at Barbara while she's playing. So they called in some of the fellows who were in the corridor there, and they say, would you fellas please come in and look at Barbara admiringly? That's what happened.
That's really funny. And how did you feel about the cover, about the album photo?
I wasn't crazy about it. because I always remembered the circumstances under which it happened, you know. But that was the idea. Whether that feeling came through, or whether that translated on the cover, I'm not sure. They were supposed to be overwhelmed with what I was playing. I'm not sure that is the expression that they had.
Well, Barbara Carroll, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Barbara Carroll speaking with Terry Gross in 2003. Her latest CD is called Live at Birdland. She's performing this Sunday and next Sunday at the Oak Room in New York's Algonquin Hotel. If you go there, beware of the cat. Coming up, film critic David Edelstein reviews Me and You and Everyone We Know. But don't be alarmed, it's the title of a movie. This is Fresh Air. The new film Me and You and Everyone We Know won major prizes at this year's Sundance and Cannes film festivals. It's the first feature by Miranda July, who also stars as a woman on the edge of a nervous breakthrough. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
Miranda July is a solo performance artist, and I can picture her acting out the script of her debut feature, Me and You and Everyone We Know, in her bedroom. The movie actually opens in the bedroom of the character she plays, Christine, who by day drives a cab for elderly people, but is also, yes, a budding performance artist. There's a picture on the wall of lovers staring at a sunset, and Christine supplies their dialogue as they pledge to live each day courageously and with grace. A short time later, she's smitten with a shoe salesman named Richard, played by John Hawkes. He's newly single, still shell-shocked, with custody of two precocious young boys, and he doesn't know what to make of this weird chick's instant intimacies. Back in her bedroom, Christine writes Me and You on pink slippers and enacts a drama with her feet. One slipper moves close and the other away, and vice versa. Does that sound like Fatal Attraction? Maybe. But this attraction is revitalizing, not fatal, and so is the movie. It's romantic, dreamlike, funny, often squirm-inducing, and sometimes shocking. Christine and Richard are not the only people on screen. Me and You and Everyone We Know is a multi-generational ensemble comedy, with characters from 6 to 75 enacting their own romantic and sexual psychodramas. July's skill with the cast is surprising, because solo performance artists can have a hard time getting out of their own heads and into other people's. But July makes every character here a kind of solo performer, acting out in the desperate hope of connecting. Early on, while his wife is moving out and his boys are staring at their computer, the distraught Richard stages his own performance piece. He sets his hand on fire and watches it burn. Later, he and Christine face each other shyly in the shoe department, holding her freshly glued compact case, waiting for it to dry, and she brings up his bandaged hand.
How'd you do that?
Oh, well, do you want the long version or the short version?
The long one.
I was trying to save my life and it didn't work.
What's the short one?
I burned it.
And when do you get to take that off?
I don't know. I think when it stops hurting.
I love the way Christine says the long one without hesitating a millisecond. And that shimmering, plinking music by Mike Andrews adds just the right touch of enchantment. July has large, blue-gray eyes, pale skin, and a delivery that's slightly etherized. That ether is defensive. Christine looks at Richard longingly but furtively and quickly pulls back into her shell. Me and You and Everyone We Know suggests that it's the human condition to be a solo performer, especially now, in an increasingly private culture. The movie is a haunting meditation on the mediated life. Face-to-face encounters are alien and terrifying. People reach out through online chat rooms and performance art, or else they retreat into fantasy. Richard's adorable 6-year-old boy meets someone in an internet chat room and engages in a pre-sexual fantasy based on, well, what else do 6-year-olds think about? Poop. Two giggly teenage girls poised to become sexually active enact their own fantasy with a grown-up who posts smutty messages for them in his window. The fact that they're all goofball dreamer role players makes this creepy funny instead of just creepy. There's also a fascinating 10-year-old girl named Sylvie, who could be Miranda July at an early age. Her mission is to collect things for a hope chest that she'll someday turn over to the one she loves. I think of Me and You and Everyone We Know as a cinematic hope chest. July even finds a place to comment on the world of performance art, to go meta. The director of the local art institute, Nancy, played by Tracy Wright, is buttoned up and dismissive and can barely look Christine in the eye when she arrives to submit a tape for a digital culture exhibit. Christine only gets through to Nancy on video. The director is alone in her office at night, staring at a monitor, and Christine calls out to her across the existential chasm. Christine's videotape is charming, embarrassing, a bit annoying, but once Nancy opens herself up to it, totally winning. just like me and you and everyone we know.
David Edelstein is film critic for Slate. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Sherrock. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. For Terry Gross, I'm David B. Inculli.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's at 1-877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Carnegie Corporation of New York, a foundation with a mandate from Andrew Carnegie to promote the advancement and diffusion of knowledge and understanding. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, jazz pianist Jason Moran talks about reinterpreting music from stride piano to hip-hop and writing his own music. The piece we're listening to now is from his Gangsterism series. Join us for the next Fresh Air.